Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
And a very good evening from Damien O'Mara. You're very welcome to Game On. It's Friday, November 5th. Thank you very much to Jenny and the team for the last couple of hours. Coming up between now and 7 o'clock, Paul O'Connell knows a little about playing 100 times for Ireland. We are going to hear from him as Jonathan Sexton is ready to break that landmark against Japan.
You know, when I played, he was a great guy to have as a captain on the team because, you know, he didn't wait for other people to lead, or he didn't look for the captain to always be on top of people. He just drove the team on relentlessly himself. So I think that's the big thing. The way he reacts to winning is the big thing for me.
We are going to get the big news from the FAI with Technical Director Ruud Doctor set to leave his role. We'll round up the news around the grounds on another big night in the Premier Division League of Ireland run-in. Plus, we will have David Connolly and Fergal Brennan ahead of a big weekend, which is going to be dominated largely in terms of the English Premier League by the Manchester Derby.
So maybe in the future, Manchester City will buy a proper striker, number nine, which is ninth. They don't score goals. Who knows? So we are who we are, and we will move forward in this sense.
Poor Pep. If just they buy what it is he needs rather than buying everything else that they bought. Jane Mangan will preview the Irish prospects at the Breeders' Cup. We'll be live to Nürburgring as well to hear from Ireland's latest F1 hope. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so. Our text number is 51552, or you can tweet us at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
So we have all of that to come between now and 7 o'clock. Would love to hear from you. If you're out and about, you want to make contact with us, 51552 is our text number. You can tweet us at GameOn2FM. So Paul O'Connell to come shortly. We'll look ahead to the soccer weekend as well. Jonathan Sexton tomorrow will become the 7th Irish player to play 100 times for his country. Your quiz question tonight, name the previous 6. And as with all of these things, you'll get to 5 and then you'll go, oh God, who is it? Who is it? And it'll be someone really obvious. Right, we are going to chat about that and an awful lot more over the course of the programme. Some significant news from a soccer perspective coming from the FAI earlier, where it was confirmed that the FAI's High Performance Director, Ruud Doctor, is set to leave his position at the end of 2021. He'd served 8 years in the role. I think his initial contract was due to expire at the end of 2020, and there was obviously an extension put in place to bridge COVID and everything else that impacted on the last couple of years. So he will be departing the role at the end of the year, and we're going to chat about this and more with Paul Corry, who joins us. Paul, how are you?
I'm good, Damien. How are you?
Not too bad. Thanks for being with us. A lot to analyse, and a lot that no doubt will kind of play out in the wash in the coming weeks and months if Ruud Doctor does media, or Jonathan Hill, the chief executive of the association, does media. But if we look at the FAI as a kind of two sides to the same coin, you've the FAI, the business, which Jonathan Hill was a very impressive appointment for as chief executive. But in footballing terms, this is this has the potential to be a real landmark moment for the FAI to replace Ruud Doctor and who it is they appoint to drive the kind of technical side of the association onwards.
Absolutely, Damien. And listen, this is, like you mentioned, is a very important role with regards to the playing side of football, both the senior team, but also when you look at the underage groups and just the culture of Irish football. And listen, Ruud Doctor has been in that role for an awful long time now, 8 years. And I understand that he's somewhat behind the scenes, but it's very hard to pinpoint exactly where his work has gone during the 8 years. I guess the most pivotal piece of work that he's had, Damien, is the introduction of the underage leagues within the League of Ireland, that under 13s, 15s, 17s and 19s, which we've been crying out for a long, long time. But that's something that's been in the UK academies for as long as I can remember back. And we've been missing that. And that is probably his most impressive piece of work. There's probably people along the way who maybe felt that their opinions weren't taken into consideration. You're probably looking to schoolboy clubs, particularly the DDSL. But to be fair to Ruud Doctor, he pressed on, whether he divided opinion or not. I think it was a positive that he got those leagues in, and that's probably his big piece of work. Outside of that, the Vera Powell appointment is probably another one where you look, and the reason that evidence would suggest that was a good appointment. But as a whole, like, this is somebody who was set out to, you know, have a clear vision of how to develop players in Ireland. When I look around the schoolboy leagues and I look around at just how football is played and how younger players are developed, I don't really see a consistency to that game. And I would have been involved in those underage leagues for the last number of years, whether that be coaching or just watching games. And we don't seem to have made that huge progression that I would have expected. The structures are there, but I'm not sure as a philosophy and a culture, I'm not sure we've really made that progression.
But the problem with all of this is, and you know, to look at it from the flip side, you've got a situation where you mentioned like the DDSL and the Dublin District Schoolboys League, for people that aren't familiar with the acronym, but you know, there is a problem insofar as you have so many different leagues, so many different structures, so many different power bases, and in order to revolutionise the entire thing, somewhere along the way, you need to get, it's a effectively turkeys voting for Christmas to give the FAI the central power. And the problem is, I'm not quite sure, Rude Doctor, you know, you could have had Kofi Annan in to try and negotiate some of that. That it was a very wide-ranging role, and it was a role that needed real revolution in some areas.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can peel it all back, Damien, and it's as much a diplomatic role as it is, you know, a technical director of a football organisation. There are a lot of politics that have to be managed, and there's a lot of relations there that you're trying to improve with people who don't necessarily trust one another or get on with one another. So I feel for them in that sense, because there seems to be people pulling in opposite directions with regards to Irish football. But maybe just taking it, you know, forward, Damien, and looking to the future and thinking of that person who actually might go into the role. I don't think it needs to be somebody with a big name or somebody who's had a stellar playing career. I'm not sure if people are aware, but Dan Ashworth is somebody who went into the English FA and did an incredible job. And to many people, they wouldn't actually know who Dan Ashworth is. Like, his playing career wasn't great. He started off in Cambridge as a director of football. Then he was Aidy Boothroyd's assistant in West Brom Academy. And then he took the English role, which was a huge role to take on at that time, because English involvement in the Premier League wasn't huge. Their underage teams weren't performing. And he completely revolutionised it. The playing style, the DNA of what they were looking for, certain players in certain positions. He rolled that out across all the major academies, across all the international teams, and was able to implement that. Now, that's something that we need. It doesn't have to be somebody with a massive CV. It's somebody who's got a really clear understanding of what is expected from that role, somebody who can actually get people on board and row in behind them in order to actually improve you know, the philosophy and the culture that I was talking about of that identity of what it means to be an Irish footballer, because we've been lacking that. And, you know, you could show up and watch an Irish an underage game and two teams will be playing completely different. And I'm not saying that one style fits all, but at least you should be able to see patterns of play that have come from the top throughout the different age groups and giving players the structures and the beliefs and the identity of what it is that we're expecting from them at different ages, so that, you know, that pathway is created for them. So Dan Ashworth, who's actually gone into Brighton now and done the exact same thing, very impressive job. That's the type of person that you'd be looking for. We're not going to get him, but somebody of that mould.
Yeah, and it's that combination of somebody who has perhaps been a student of how things have operated in other countries, particularly countries where there is great competition among sports to try and get the hearts and minds of kids at a relatively young age, and also somebody who understands the Irish psyche, because as passionate as we all are about this fine nation of ours, we are a contrary or unique bunch of individuals to try and deal with in certain circumstances. So that combination is really key.
Yeah, and somebody who, you know, I guess understands the lay of the land here and understands the different stakeholders that need to be brought on board. We need to be realistic here. Our numbers of involvement playing at the top end of the Premier League or in the Premier League alone are dwindling, and we really don't have many young players who are pressing through. Yes, there's a couple there who have shown some promise, but with regards to where we were 5-10 years ago, we're way off it. So we need to be honest. There's something that's not in place at this moment in time that needs to be fixed. So somebody with a clear vision and an understanding of what it takes to be an elite level footballer while managing all the domestic stakeholders is something that I would see as probably being perfect for that role.
Okay, just on Rude Doctor then, when history comes to judge him in time, I think there's an awful lot of people for whom he is seen as a pillar of the previous regime, and there's an awful lot of people, you know, for no reason other than they worked in the FAI over a number of years, that there's a kind of a clamour for change. But when it comes time with a rational approach for his legacy to be assessed, does he have more credit in the bank than debit in your mind?
Not in my mind, Damien. Now, I don't want to be too critical and say, you know, what has he done, but I just, you know, the underage leagues were crying out. It was so obvious that it needed to be implemented, and he did that, and he managed to get that over the line. I think when you look beyond that, it's very hard to pinpoint the work that he's done that's really given those younger players that foundation to actually build their careers upon. So, I mean, I think it's the right time to change this, and I don't want to be too critical, but probably something that I would have expected more from him then.
Okay, we'll leave it there, Paul. Thanks so much for being with us. Paul Corrie with us there. 51552, our number for your text. You can tweet us at GameOn2FM. We're going to hear from Paul O'Connell and James Lowe on the far side of the break. Stay with us.
Dinners made easy with Green Farm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on, rugby.
And you are very welcome back to the programme. So at this stage tomorrow, well, if you're of a rugby persuasion anyway, you'll be deep into analysing what hopefully will be a victory for Ireland over Japan at the Aviva Stadium, the opening game of the Autumn Nations Series. And I think the expectation, the hope certainly is that we'll be a positive springboard into the game against New Zealand the following Saturday. So tomorrow's game live as part of an extended Saturday Sport over on RTE Radio 1. They're on air at 12:55 on Radio 1 Extra, which is most easily accessed through the RTE Radio Player app, and then coverage of the game continues on Radio 1 FM after 2 o'clock, and the match is live as well on RTE 2 television, and if you're out and about, trackers and everything else on the RTE website. So an awful lot to look forward to. We hope it is Ireland's, it's their 10th occasion that the two nations have met. Ireland have won 8 of the previous games, Japan winning one, that quite notably coming at the 2019 Rugby World Cup. Ireland obviously going into this off the back of a 39-31 victory when the sides met earlier this year. It's a much changed Irish side. Obviously the Lions contingents are back, and a lot of focus, and justifiably so, on where Ireland might be at in terms of preparation. Japan with plenty of games under their belt. A lot of the Irish players have had limited game time in the United Rugby Championship, and you don't have that springboard of the European games, the Champions Cup games, which traditionally have fallen in advance of this November window. So, are Ireland, or could Ireland, be ever so slightly undercooked in advance of the game tomorrow? A question which was put today to the Ireland forwards coach, Paul O'Connell.
Yeah, for sure, it's a little bit of a challenge for us, the game time, but we train quite hard since we came in. We've had two kind of big sessions, a big session on Saturday, which was very fast, quite physical as well. You know, in terms of forward play, certainly scrummaging-wise, line-out-wise, the amount we did and the time span we did them in kind of put the players under pressure or above-match pressure. We did the same on Wednesday. So it's not the same as a match, but I think a lot of the guys have enjoyed the speed we've trained at and the intensity we've trained at, and they've felt they've gotten value out of it. A lot of them have a lot of very good work in the bank, you know. I mean, I think Irish players, the way they're managed, the way they train, they tend to be naturally very, very fit players, and tends to be something we go to and we rely on. So for sure, we'd love to be coming in here on the back of two big weeks where there's a bit of, you know, you're playing those European Cup games and you're coming in a little bit of stress from having to call lineouts in those games, having to scrummage in big European games, and then having to go around the field and play a match. We'd love to have that, but we've replicated it well in training, and a lot of the guys have a really good bank of work behind them over the last number of years anyway, and it's something Irish players are very good at, is working on their fitness, looking after their fitness. So we'd still see it as a strength of ours and a go-to of ours.
So that's Paul O'Connell chatting earlier. So we've had a couple of those big sessions, as he mentions, in training. So who are the players who have stood up and have impressed since the squad went into camp?
They've all impressed us. You know, we kind of went down a certain path in the summer around some of the things we were looking for from players, and it's been very cool to see them delivering some of it
within the, I suppose, the framework they have in their clubs. And then it's been great to see so many of them come in and pick it up really quickly. You know, it's a real challenge we have up here, is the amount of time you get with your players before you play a big game in the Six Nations or you play a big game in the autumn. You only get a handful of training sessions. So you need players that can, I suppose, pick up what we want to do really quickly and fall into it. And that's probably the most impressive thing I think we've had, certainly for me, this summer, this autumn. You know, you feel after two sessions, you feel like, you know, we're back to where we were at the end of the Six Nations, or we're back to where we were in the summer. And again, I think it's the strength of Irish players. They're smart rugby players. I suppose we have a great academy system where players get really well educated, and they're in really good environments in their provinces where they're getting better and better coaching all the time. So I love how when we come into camp, they pick things up really quickly, and we're on to, you know, 2 days in, we're on to getting better and not just, I suppose, relearning what we have been doing.
So that's Paul O'Connell in advance of the game. And one man who will start this weekend earning his seventh cap is James Lowe. Now, if you're following it, you will know he was dropped pretty bluntly at the end of the Six Nations and then missed out during the summer as a result of injury. But he has gone about kind of working on a certain number of areas. Was highly praised by the Irish head coach Andy Farrell yesterday for how he's gone off and has sought areas of improvement. It was interesting in the press conference when James Lowe spoke to the media yesterday after the team naming, he's pretty blunt, you know. Yeah, I was told earlier in the year just wasn't good enough, and you have a couple of areas to go off and work upon. So that's a question I put to him. Just how blunt is the analysis? How clinical does it have to be? And his approach to how it is you go about improving and making sure you can be at that top level for international rugby?
I guess we would expand a lot more on that's not good enough, obviously, but it's, I mean, at the end of the day, that's how, I mean, you can word it whichever way you want, but, and yeah, like I said, it wasn't good enough, and a lot of technical areas that you need to go home and have a look at, and look at people who are good at it, have conversations with people who are good at what you're trying to get better at, and yeah, it wasn't good enough. Now it's better.
And looking back on those games now, would you concede that perhaps the adjustment from top-tier club level to the international level was something that perhaps took, maybe, is it a greater adjustment than you expected or that you might have been prepared for?
Yeah, you could definitely put it that way. But, you know, I wasn't out of my depth by any means. It was just like, you know, my plus-minus was probably closer to a flat line than what I expected myself and what the team needed of me as well. So, you know, with ball, that's always been my bread and butter. It's always been something that comes very natural. So it's been able to impact the rugby game without the ball in my hand is literally what I've been gone away and worked on, and come back in a, you know, in a student of trying to learn off the best in the game. And that's where we're at.
So that's where we're at. That's James Lowe chatting in advance of that game, Ireland against Japan, live on RT2 television, live as well on RT Radio 1 Extra from 12:55, and then live on FM on Saturday Sport over on Radio 1, the culmination of that game tomorrow afternoon. And then after that, it will be all eyes on New Zealand as they land into the Aviva Stadium Saturday, tomorrow week. New Zealand playing Italy tomorrow, and if you were to be, I don't want to be a merchant of doom, but you look at the results they had against Wales last weekend and the performances, you'd imagine they'll do similar against Italy tomorrow. So a big task awaits Ireland in 8 days' time, but they will be focused on Japan tomorrow. So we wish them all well. A lot to look forward to on the soccer weekend. We'll chat about Eddie Howe on his way to Newcastle, if you believe the rumours, Xavi on his way to Barcelona, and the Manchester Derby, the highlight of the weekend. All of that to come after the break.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game On Football.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. 51552 for your texts. We're going to look ahead to the English Premier League weekend and a couple of other big stories doing the rounds in soccer. We'll chat in just a second to Fergal Brennan, but David Connolly is with us as well. David, how are you?
Good evening, Damien. How are you?
Not too bad. It's good to talk to you. We have a little bit of a delay on the line, but we'll do our best to make sure it doesn't impact on us too badly. Can I talk to you initially about Newcastle, the big story now? Again, we've had this situation where we've had a couple of managers now who were on the verge of being appointed as the Newcastle manager, and it's yet to actually happen. But Eddie Howe expected to be confirmed in the coming hours. Is he a distinct improvement on Steve Bruce, or are the club kind of in, you know, making do with what it is they can do in the situation they're in?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because, you know, if you look at Newcastle's problems, and there's quite a few, but Eddie was known for obviously attacking football, you know, trying to dominate the ball, but they conceded, you know, an awful lot of goals. It was basically 60 a season for nearly every season, and Newcastle are in the mire for that exact same reason. Now, you know, it's ambitious to go for Unai Emery, make no mistake, and they went for someone who's obviously won so much. You know, for Eddie, who's much more experienced in the Premier League, and I'm sure he'll have the respect of the players, but it might be like the cart before the horse, because they don't seem to have the rest of the pieces in place, like, you know, maybe a technical director or a director of football. So it looks a bit like a short-term appointment, to be honest.
But you see, isn't this the problem, that it's all well and good to build this club, to buy this club, but realistically, what player, unless they are going purely for financial reasons, is going to go to a club which are amongst the favourites for relegation? It's a real catch-22 situation.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the only thing I'd say, look, I lived in the Northeast, and it is a great place to live. Now, if you put two clubs on the table, obviously, and you know, one's in the north of England and one's down south, you know, you'd think with the money they've got now, they'll have to pay a little bit extra. But, you know, I don't really envisage that being an issue. What would be the draw of going to Newcastle, you'd say, at times, if they'd have got a manager like Antonio Conte, then you'd get players who go, well, you know what, I'm going here, a proven winner. But they kind of haven't got that if it's going to be Eddie. So, I think they've got a lot of work to do if Eddie is the man. That's not to say I don't rate Eddie, but I'm just not too sure he's going to be the draw, you know, that they would need, as well as the geography and the money.
Mm. Fergal, it is increasingly looking to be a case of, okay, you know, fair play to their ambition, fair play to the money that they've been able to put in, albeit it's effectively a state-sponsored operation. But are we starting to see very quickly that the owners of Newcastle don't actually know an awful lot about football?
Yeah, I think David's absolutely right. This idea that there's so little in terms of a behind-the-scenes structure in place. There's been so many comparisons to Manchester City and the operation that they put in place since getting bought out in 2008. It took years for Manchester City to build up a structure of a director of football, a coaching team, a scouting network, and all these other various positions that have been strengthened then by Pep Guardiola bringing in some of his own kind of trusted lieutenants that he had with him at Barcelona. These things take a long time, and I think ultimately whoever takes this job, it does look as if it is going to be Eddie Howe, probably appointed in the next couple of days. They're almost putting themselves on the chopping block, in the sense that they know that, yeah, even if they keep Newcastle up and they keep them in the Premier League for next season, the ultimate medium to long-term aims of the club's new ownership are much, much higher than that. And as it stands, they don't really seem to be aware of the amount of building blocks, the amount of pieces that need to be put in the jigsaw puzzle to have a successful Premier League team. These things do take time. I know it might sound boring and Newcastle fans want to see success immediately. Of course, that's understandable, but these things do take a long time. And Eddie Howe's a positive manager. Players that have worked with him always speak very highly of him. I do agree with David that I think defensively there's big misgivings over him as a coach and as a manager. He will bring a bit of positivity back to St. James's Park, but ultimately, is he a manager that's going to bring them to be challenging into the top four, bringing massive names to the club? No, probably not. But there always had to be a first manager of this new dawn at Newcastle. It's probably not the most enviable job in Premier League football, but somebody had to take it. And Eddie Howe's an ambitious coach who wants to get himself back in Premier League football, and this looks to be a fairly logical route for him.
Yeah, and realistically as well, before we move on, let's look at it that, you know, departing with Steve Bruce was as much a PR exercise as it was anything else, because that's what the fans wanted and that's what the new owners came in and delivered. David, if we look ahead to the weekend that's in store, the big game that jumps out is the Manchester Derby, United playing host to City at half past 12 tomorrow afternoon. And is this difficult to call insofar as you just simply do not know what type of Manchester United is going to turn up? That all logic dictates that Manchester City could do as good a job on them as Liverpool did a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, look, that is obviously that's possible. I mean, what you would say is, you know, now John Stones has been basically on the periphery all season. He finally, you know, started him against Bruges. Then he sort of scored an own goal. Now, if John's playing at the back, you know, if you look at the movement and how United scored their goals the other day, yeah, the back heel from Fernandes, you know, Ronaldo give him half a yard in the box, you think, well, you know, maybe Pep might have a couple of problems here, because, you know, I think he should have started John Stones a little bit more as it is now, or whether it's somebody else. But I think John will play, and that might be the little chink that I think United, look, John Stones is a great player, but he ain't played enough football to suddenly chuck him into the derby. By the same virtue, you look at United and you go, well, I mean, I saw Phil Foden against Brighton, and that kid is so quick, not just with the ball, without the ball. He is quicker than people think. And you look at a movement, you know, even from Atalanta, in behind United, I think they will cause problems. So I think the game will obviously be won, probably in both boxes, you know, but I think it's a big ask to just chuck John Stones in, and I think that's because he ain't really played enough football, you know, for me.
But, like, Fergal, when we look at it again and we talk about kind of mismanagement of football clubs or the footballing ability of executives at clubs, you look at the results for United, 1-5 in the league. You know, the Liverpool result, in a way, you're coming up against one of the best teams in Europe. The defeat against Leicester is damning. The draw at home to Everton is damning. The loss at home to Aston Villa. Like, you know, it's... I know people accuse people in the media of, you know, stoking a fire against Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but it's just, like, it wouldn't surprise you if they had another absolute disaster tomorrow and he's left lamenting, well, we did well against Atalanta during the week and we'll do well against Watford next weekend.
Yeah, and I mean, I do fully get this idea that we don't know which Manchester United is going to turn up, and if a good Manchester United or positive Manchester United turn up, there is the chance of them getting a result. They've obviously got world-class players in that team, and they've got Cristiano Ronaldo, who's on absolute fire at the minute. But I think this is a different beast to United teams that have faced Pep Guardiola's City in the past. Just looking at Solskjaer's record, the last four games against City in the Premier League, he's unbeaten against them. But that was when he set his team up very, very tight, very, very organised. They looked to kind of negate City's threat and hit them on the counter. They will try and do that to an extent tomorrow, even though they're at home at Old Trafford. But this is a very different team now, and so much of what United do is geared around Ronaldo. And Ronaldo, in some ways, is not the most conducive to a counter-attacking team, because he likes to be involved in different phases of the play. I know he likes to get on the end of stuff in the box and finish off chances, but he does like to be a bit more involved than many people think. And City have got so many players. David's touched on Phil Foden there. And when you look at Manchester United at the back, they've brought in this new back three system, which hasn't really convinced in the last few games. Obviously, they beat Tottenham, but they've had to make changes in every single game. That was Lindelof, Maguire and Varane. Then against Atalanta in midweek, Eric Bailly comes in because Lindelof had an injury. Then Rafa Varane goes off injured. Varane's not fit tomorrow. Lindelof is rated 50-50 according to Solskjaer. So whichever way it goes, you're playing a back three with a different set of players for the third game in a row against the Man City side that have got so much movement. They can look to create chances in front of you. They can run in behind. I do see this idea that United and Solskjaer, backs against the wall, have kind of shown their best in the last 18 months. But I think they've maybe gone too far to look for this sort of a Hail Mary result. This block of six games, which ends this weekend, that was kind of made to decide what would happen at Manchester United in terms of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. The picture's not really any much clearer. They beat Tottenham, but that was a Tottenham that were in terrible form. I still think his position in terms of what he's producing at Manchester United hasn't changed. But whether that's enough for the club to press the eject button, I still don't necessarily think so.
But David, just give me the insight from someone who's been involved in clubs and has obviously, you know, you've played under managers who changed mid-season and everything else. Like, you know, we can fixate ourselves on over-analysing body language and over-analysing. You know, there was a situation during the week where he was deep in conversation with Luke Shaw and it was being spun as if he was trying to get direction from Shaw rather than manage the team. That it's just increasingly a no-win situation for Solskjaer, isn't it?
Well, for managers in general, right? I mean, it's a tough ask, as we were talking last week. You know, managers losing it's the sacking season, getting to Christmas. I mean, look, when Ronaldo comes off and he's on the bench, people think he's telling Ollie what to do. Now, in some ways, obviously, Ollie is a bit different, right? Because Ollie is a bit younger. He's not that long, you know, retired. He's played with some of these players, and I think his way of leading is sort of, he's trying to be on their level. He's not necessarily above them like a helicopter. He's on the same level, saying, right, okay. And he's getting their involvement and their input. And people might say, well, you know, they might need a firmer hand or you need to have that distance, you know. But I think he's trying to look, you can't change that he used to play with someone and he's a similar age. I played with Roy and I ended up, but Roy Keane, he ended up being my manager, you know. Now there was a gap, but there was also sort of some parallels in that, you know, not long ago we were sharing a pitch together, you know. So, and it's a different relationship you have with your players, and I think Ollie allows his players to have a voice. And, you know, people can misconstrue that or say that he doesn't have authority or he's not authoritative enough, etc. But ultimately, that's his style of managing, you know. Yeah. So, look, Graham Potter does the same. You go and watch Brighton and Graham Potter will be talking to his players, you know, pre-game, during game. You know, no one says anything about that. But obviously, the microscope on Ollie is just so much more, it's so much more intense. You know, that's what he's up against. Yeah, and obviously, look, some of the results don't help. Make no mistake.
But yeah, it is one of those ones. Klopp hugs his players. He's a brilliant manager. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is talking to his players. He's the teacher's pet who's been left in charge while the teacher steps out of the room. So you can't win. Fergal, exactly. We look at the games over the weekend. Like Chelsea, you'd fancy them to do a job at home to Burnley in one of the 3 o'clock kickoffs tomorrow. And if we look at it, if you know, is there the potential there that Chelsea are just going to run away with this league and that there, you know, there's the potential for them just to cut everyone else adrift?
There is. I mean, what they're doing is just this constant efficiency that maybe there's a little chink in the armour for a Liverpool or a Manchester City so far. I still believe that Liverpool and City are the best two teams in the Premier League. They're the best two teams in English football. But Chelsea will be happy for people like me and other people to make those sort of statements and let all the attention be on Liverpool and Manchester City. Obviously, City looking to defend their title. Chelsea are just getting on with the kind of bread and butter job of winning games, maintaining their position at the top of the table. They got a bit of good fortune last weekend because City lost to Crystal Palace and Liverpool drew with Brighton. And Thomas Tuchel is such a fantastic manager that everything is down to the details with him. We talked about conversations between players and managers and how things get set up and things that go on behind the scenes. He plans absolutely everything for Chelsea. So there's no room left for doubt. There's no room left for kind of taking your foot off the gas in terms of intensity. And Burnley got themselves first Premier League win of the season last weekend. But yeah, I fully fancy Chelsea to win this, then keep that little gap at the top of the table going into the international break. And they can fully do it. I think in terms of being able to win the league, they're definitely as capable as Manchester City and Liverpool. As I say, I still think those two are better sides, but there has been little wobbles with them. Liverpool are conceding probably more goals than they'd like to, and then Man City can turn in a Crystal Palace every now and again, whereas you just don't really see Chelsea having that many wobbles, certainly not in the short term.
David, before I let you go, obviously Spurs fans got a first look at the Antonio Conte regime last night. You'd feel sorry for a manager coming in a way, because it's such a relentless start to the campaign, into the Conference League and then straight bouncing into a game away to Everton at the weekend. So I presume from his perspective, it's just about a sense of, you know, stability. Let's get up and running and judge me in a couple of weeks' time on ultimately what it is I want to see from this group.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, to be honest, he could have left that game and taken over post the game, and you know, but he wants to get in and get stuck in. Obviously, he puts an awful lot of onus on work on the training ground. I know people that have worked under him. I know staff that have worked under him. I know staff that worked with him in Italy and said, you know, it's relentless. You've got to be prepared for it. You know, double video meetings, double training, sometimes triple training sessions. You know, he is relentless, and everything that you hear about it is true. But look, he is a fantastic coach, you know, and I think he's a real coup for Tottenham. He really is.
David, we'll let you go. Thanks so much for being with us. Fergal, before I let you go, Xavi on his way to the new camp. Again, we talk about thankless jobs. I suppose it was inevitable he was going to take charge at some stage, but you would feel sorry for a man going into Barcelona at the minute, albeit a legend of his standing will be given probably more time in the club than perhaps Ronald Koeman, who's more of a historical legend, would have received.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, there's a sense of inevitability about him going back to Barcelona, and Al Saad, the team that he's been managing in Qatar, have pretty much said that in terms of their willingness to let him go and get the deal wrapped up over the weekend. I think in terms of his position and his status at the club, he's much higher up the Barcelona food chain than Ronald Koeman. Ronald Koeman obviously has that big moment going back to 1992 where he scored the winner in the European Cup final, but Xavi was the metronome, the captain for a long time in the best Barcelona, arguably the best ever club side in the history of football. So he will be given a bit more time. And I think the line with him coming back to Barcelona is this idea that they can't keep just bringing in managers that are just kind of, you're almost throwing a dart at a dartboard and going, we'll go for him. We saw it before with Quique Setién and Ernesto Valverde. Barcelona are always a club where the manager needs to buy into absolutely everything that the club involves and being manager of the club. And Xavi will do that. In terms of how much success that will translate into, that remains to be seen. They need major surgery moving into the next 18 months to 2 years because there's some big, big names moving towards the end of their career. But he is probably as bulletproof an appointment as Barcelona can get. That'll take a bit of the heat off the board because the financial issues that they're having. But he's got a big job on his hands because alongside getting Barcelona back on track, he's probably going to have to end the careers of some of his friends and former teammates.
Yeah, it's not easy. Yeah, when you look at the age profile within that club. Fergal, thanks for being with us. Fergal Brennan there and David Connolly in advance of that. An awful lot more still to come on the programme. We're going to look ahead to the Breeders' Cup weekend with Jane Mangan. We're going to whip around a couple of grounds in advance of a very, very big night in the SSE Airtricity League Premier Division. And coming up after the break, we are going to chat to a man who has very lofty ambitions in the world of motorsport, and justifiably so. Stay with us.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Fern's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. We are going to look ahead to the Breeders' Cup weekend and the League of Ireland evening in a couple of minutes' time. But in advance of that, it's, you know, we talk time and time again. One of the great pleasures of this job is to bring you stories of Irish success on the international stage. And as well as that is to talk to people who we hope in years to come will really make a name for themselves and make a name for the country on the international stage. And we are going to do that right now by crossing to the Nürburgring, where round six of the Formula 4 season takes place this weekend. The 2021 German Formula 4 season concludes this weekend. And delighted to say there's strong Irish interest in the form of 15-year-old Alex Dunn, who joins us now from Germany. Alex, how are you?
Hi, how are you? I'm good, thanks.
Good. Come here. Thanks for joining us. It's good to talk to you. And I should say congratulations, because I know you have a busy weekend of racing to come, but you've had practice and a lot else today, and you've made a very, very impressive start to the weekend. Give us a little bit of insight into how today has gone for you.
Yeah, thank you. Obviously, yesterday we had the first free practice session of the weekend, which was mainly about learning the track for me, as Nürburgring is a new challenge and a new track for me. I've never been here before. So I was mainly using the two free practice sessions as kind of my way of just getting into the track and settling in. So yesterday was dry and today was slightly damp, half wet, half dry. And we ended practice two P1 and then coming into quali after only having one practice session in the dry, still took me a little bit of time to bed in. So it was kind of quali one was still just learning the track and getting used to everything. So we ended up P5 in quali one and P2 in quali two.
So do you go into a weekend like this, do you set yourself targets in terms of what it is you want to achieve, or is it just a case of this is a brand new experience in terms of a track you've never raced on before, and you know, there's that dividing line between wanting to do as well as you can do and just enjoying the experience?
Well, I think after racing at such a high level in karting, I've always been in a situation where I had to adapt if we ever came to a track where we hadn't had much practice. So My goals for the weekend have still stayed the same. My goal is obviously to win, but yeah, I knew this weekend it would be a little bit of a harder task. But I still believed in myself and my ability that it was possible to do the same here as what I've done at any other track.
Now, the Nürburgring, for those of us who've watched Formula One over the years, obviously it has been a venue for the German Grand Prix, the European Grand Prix and the Luxembourg Grand Prix. Is that the exact same track that you race on? So is it a slightly different track within the Nürburgring? Because it must be mind-blowing to turn up and race on something that you've either maybe played in a computer game or, like most of us, have watched on television.
Yeah, Nürburgring is a very prestigious track and it's an incredible facility. I remember when we drove up to the track, all the huge buildings outside and the incredible facility was really nice to see, especially driving on one of the most famous Formula One tracks in the world. But yeah, we're driving on pretty much the same layout as what the Formula One Grand Prix went to this year. We do a slightly shorter layout than what they did in Formula One. But it's mainly the same.
Okay, can you explain to me? So you're 15 years of age. I'm told your birthday next week. So can I get in early with the first happy birthday of the year? So
thank you.
But how does a lad from Clonbillogue in Offaly get to this level? Where did your love of motorsport and your first experience with karting, how did you get into it?
Well, my first guess you say look on motorsport started when I was around 5 or 6 years old. I always used to go to the racetracks with my dad when he was racing, so I've always been around it from a very early age. And I remember when I was 9, then he introduced me into karting, and he brought us down to our local kart track as boy in Meath, and ever since I sat in the seat, I've loved it ever since.
And I don't want to put too much pressure on you, but you know, you've done really, really well this year. Am I right in saying you've had a couple of 4 rookie wins from 6 starts? You've had a couple of pole positions along the way as well. That, like, it's gone really well. And you know, this is what you want to make a career of. You want to join John Watson and Eddie Irvine and other guys like that who've raced at the very pinnacle of the sport.
Yeah, it's a great feeling to be one of the very few Irish people at a really high level in motorsport. So far, as my rookie season has gone in F4, it's gone very well. I've had quite a few rookie wins, many podiums, 3 pole positions. So far so good.
And just the challenge with all of this is, obviously, I know you have to keep an eye on school. And have you done your junior cert, or is junior cert coming down the tracks?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I actually
okay.
didn't do my junior cert.
Okay, well, okay.
I do my.
No, go on.
I do my. Sorry, carry on. Sorry.
No, you're grand. No, so you're balancing all. Like, you're balancing school and life of a teenager with motorsport as well. Like, I'm looking at the pictures. They're like Formula One cars without the halo device. Like, they're very similar to what Formula One cars would have looked at a couple of years ago. But I'd imagine it's not the cheapest thing for yourself and your dad and everyone involved to keep going. So it's great to get that bit of success and hopefully get people's interest to come on board as sponsors and come on board to help become part of the team and part of the story.
Yeah, what you said is very true. Motorsport, unfortunately, is not one of the cheapest sports to get yourself into. I guess, at least for us as a family, financially, it's been very tough, but we managed to managed to get through it, and we've had a few great sponsors and a few great partnerships, which has really helped me along the way. One of them is one of the extremely big one of the big truck and companies in Ireland, Harris Group. They really helped us with my racing career this year, and without them and also VTL, I don't think this year would have been possible.
And if anyone wants to get involved, you'll find a space on the car somewhere to fit a logo on it. So it's alexdunracing.com is your website. But before I let you go, have you done many interviews on the radio and television like this?
I've done a couple of interviews. I did one with Dermot and Dave.
Oh yeah.
So I've done a couple of them.
Okay. I have to commend you because I'm a little bit older than you, as you might imagine, and you're far better on the radio than I am. So fair play to you.
thank you very much.
Alex,
thank you.
I look forward to chatting to you. I'm going to remind you now, when you hit Formula One, forget about Dermot, Dave and those other radio stations. I'll be on to you for the first big interview. So I wish you well this weekend, and wish you well with what I hope is going to be a great career. Good luck and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much and thank you for having me.
Great to talk to you. Alex Dunn there. Keep an eye on him. That's a man who's going to go far. We wish him well on the journey. Let's go to Finn Harps against Derry, the first of our previews in the Ronan external two. Sorry. Eric White is with us. Eric, I was like a fella dry. Like, not only am I incoherent, but I can't fly the plane either. Anyway, Harps against Derry. Off you go.
Yes, indeed, Damien. Well, it's a big game, this one, for both sides. Finn Harps currently in the relegation playoff position, 1 point behind Waterford with three games to go. And then Derry City in fourth, 6 points behind Sligo Rovers in the chase for European football next season. But fourth could be enough if St Pat's, of course, win the FAI Cup final later this month. Well, Derry did Harps a huge favour on Tuesday night when Cameron McJanet struck an injury time goal against Waterford. That was enough to rescue a point at the RSC. The Candy Stripes have a habit of plundering late goals. That was their sixth in stoppage time this season. Neither side in particularly good form of late, Derry, with just two wins from their last eight since Harp knocked them out of the FAI Cup on their last visit here. They do have Kieran Harkin back from suspension, although Roland Boyce hobbled off early in the second half on Tuesday night, so that could rule him out. Harp's no win in five for them. They struggled to break down Drogheda in a scoreless draw here on Monday. Striker Sean Boyd sent off late in that game. He'll serve an automatic ban. Very little between the sides this season in three previous league meetings. One win each and a 2-2 draw last time out at Brandywell when both teams finished with 10 men. Big crowd expected. Chilly but dry night. Should be a great atmosphere. Kickoff is at 8 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Eric White at Finn Park. Let's go from Ballybuffet to Inchicore. Pats against Sligo. Good evening, Adrian Eames.
Good evening, Damien O'Mara. Yeah, all set here for the televised game on RTÉ television a little bit later on. It's St Pat's against Sligo Rovers. It's second against third. Pats, of course, have already nailed down Europe. And, of course, tonight they can secure second spot. But it's pretty much done and dusted that Pats will finish second with three games to go. But this is a huge game, of course, for Sligo Rovers in their pursuit of European football. Hugely important to the club as well in terms of the finance that it generates to make it through to Europe. So big, big prize at stake for Sligo Rovers, given that they play Derry next week and Bowes at home in the final match of the season. So they'll be hoping to get something from this trip to Richmond Park. It's a venue in which they've struggled really over the years. Their last win here back in 2018. Pats, of course, as we know, gearing up for the cup final at the end of the month with Bohemians. They just need a point, as I mentioned, to confirm that second place finish. Steve O'Donnell, the coach, in a happy position of being able to rotate his squad and just tweak things and get minutes into players ahead of the cup final. So tonight, Robbie Benson returns to the starting 11. Also starting roles as well for the likes of Adara Burns. Jack Hickman, who started against Bowes on Monday night, continues at right back. And Ian Birmingham is in place of Shane Griffin. Just the one change for Sligo Rovers. Mark Byrne impressed off the bench in that late 1-0 win over Longford Town on a Monday night. So he starts, the youngster from Kilkelly, in place of Walter Figuera. And John Mahon, who went off with a rolled ankle in that game, has been passed fit to play. So all set. Lovely conditions in terms of the prevailing winds here, Damien, at Richmond Park, and we're all set for a 7:45 kickoff.
Thank you very much to Adrian Eames. Let's go then to the RSC. Waterford playing host to the champions Shamrock Rovers tonight. Looking ahead to that game for us, Ray Scott.
Yes, Damien, while the title has been retained by the Tabs, it's the other end of the table that's attracting much attention. Just 8 points separating fourth from ninth in what is one of the closest Premier Division campaigns in years. Waterford's concession of an injury time equaliser to Derry on Tuesday evening was a big blow for Mark Bircham's side. The Blues still have the fate in their own hands, though, as they stand a point ahead of Harps. As long as they match the North Westerners over the final three games, they'll retain their Premier Division status. The stats not good for Waterford, though, whose last win over Shamrock Rovers came back in March 2018. In their last 10 meetings, Rovers have won 9 and only a pre-season friendly draw early last year providing any break for Waterford. This season, Rovers have taken on 9 points, but the gap has been closing. The most recent game in Tallaght being a 2-0 win for the home side. Danny Mandrew bagged a brace. He also scored in their first meeting back in May. Mark Bertram's squad down to the bare bones. Brian Murphy does return after suspension, with Paul Murphy dropping to the bench. Dara Power, Junior and Ronaldo are also on the bench this evening despite picking up knocks on Tuesday. Greg Halford starts despite a rib injury. Eddie Nolan does return. Kyle Ferguson also back down on the bench. For Stephen Bradley, Chris McCann is suspended. He does make 6 changes, with Leon Cole starting to the post instead of Alan Manus. Aaron Green, Sean Moore, Graham Burke, Gary O'Neill and Danny Manchin all into the starting lineup. There will be a guard of honour for Waterford for the champions, but for the both home side and the crowd, that might be the only respect or hope will be shown this evening. Kick-off here, 7:45.
Thank you very much, Ray. Let's finish the programme by looking ahead to the Breeders' Cup weekend. Here's Shane Mangan.
Game on, racing.
Yes, Damien, when it comes to the world of horse racing, we Irish folk like to consider ourselves pretty darn good, almost even world leaders. So where better to reinforce that title than at the world's biggest stage? This weekend, the Breeders' Cup comes from Del Mar, California. We have 11 horses running there, and let's hope we bring home some dollars. We start at 9:50 tonight with Twilight Jet from Michael O'Callaghan and Lee Roach in the juvenile sprint, followed after midnight by Glown Thawn, Aidan O'Brien's sole juvenile representative, the Mount of Ryan Moore, at 12:30 tonight in the juvenile turf. But tomorrow really and truly is where our best chances lie. We start at 7:40 in the Breeders' Cup sprint with A Case of You for Aidan McGuinness and Ronan Whelan. He was brilliant in France on soft ground in the Prix de l'Abbé. Can he translate that form to quick ground in California?